Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. This is our final podcast before Christmas, not before the end of the year. And so we've got the gang back together in our Bulwark studio. Jonathan Last, the executive editor of the Bulwark and the publisher of the Bulwark, Sarah Longwell. And I'm sitting here in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. So the great thing about America right now in 2019 is that you probably heard this. It's okay to say Merry Christmas. So Merry freaking Christmas.
Thank you, Donald Trump, for giving us permission to say Merry Christmas again.
Right. You can say you can say Merry Christmas, and also your dad is probably in hell and you're human scum. But as long as you can say Merry Christmas, it would get the warm.
That's what Jesus really wanted.
That's what Jesus was really all about, you know, when you think about it. So you've read about or read the Christianity Today editorial calling for the president to be removed. The most interesting thing about that, I think, is the president's reaction. That, of course, you know, here you have the president denouncing a magazine that was actually founded by Billy Graham as apparently not sufficiently Christian. So,
yeah, it's just a left wing rag.
Well, you knew that was going to be it, because isn't that? I mean, that's like the magic bullet, right? Whatever the criticism is, whatever's happening, all you have to do is say that it is liberal or is a left wing rag, and that's okay. Then we're done with that. But it was interesting that a publication that is that influential would take that strong a stand.
Well, yeah. I mean, on the one hand, it won't matter. Surprising. But on the other hand, I mean, at some point, don't you, if you're going to have any legitimacy as a Christian witness, have to stand up and say, I mean, come on, no, not my name. You know, I mean, this is honestly, this is the smallest thing in the world. This matters not at all, right? But it really drove me insane. Mm-hmm. Do you remember last week when Nancy Pelosi said, like, you know, don't say I hate him. I don't hate him. I pray for him. Right. So in Trump's big letter, which is going to be taught in constitutional law books for centuries to come.
All of the constitutional law books. Yeah.
He said that Nancy Pelosi is lying in saying that she prays for him. And the only possible way is that she prays the opposite, mm-hmm. meaning like that she hopes he dies or something. Now, I have no idea what Nancy Pelosi does or doesn't do, but I do know that she's Catholic. And if you're Catholic, you are obligated to pray for. And mm-hmm. so she at the very least had to say that she didn't have to say it. But, you know, if she's going to stake out a position on Trump and prayer, her position as a Catholic has to be, yeah, I pray for the guy. And Trump's dismissal of this shows that he does not even understand this most fundamental and basic tenet of the Catholic faith.
But we knew that. I mean, we knew that.
But man, to have that and then to start speculating about the disposition of the soul of somebody who's been, I mean, this is the type of stuff that if you care at all about anything about Christianity, these are third rails. You don't touch that stuff. That is not anything to do with Christian witness. And at some point, people have to step off the bus. If you are not part of what is essentially a secular religion, which is, if I could just say, what a great deal of evangelical Protestants actually believe in the United States, mm-hmm. they aren't real Christians, they just believe in the secular religion of America, which they happen to ascribe to evangelical Christianity. If you're not going to be with that, if you're going to be an actual believing Christian about, you know, what the life of Jesus Christ meant, what the New Covenant means and all that stuff, you may prefer Donald Trump to, as a policy matter, to the choice. Maybe it's a binary choice, but you can't be enthusiastic about it. And if the choice is Donald Trump or Mike Pence, then okay, obviously Mike Pence is better.
Well,
let
me share with you.
I'm sorry, Sarah's giving me like these death beams here. I'm like, I am super hot and frothing at the mouth here.
The deep theological thoughts of Jack Posobiec, who tweeted yesterday, King David was an adulterer, Paul murdered Christians, Mary Magdalene was a prostitute, and Peter denied Christ. And as our former colleague, the late lamented Andrew Egger, may he rest in peace, is he tweeted out that all of these people, famously, each one of them went to their graves swaggering that they had done nothing wrong. And by the way, Mary Magdalene was not a prostitute. That's a total bullshit story. But What is interesting, you know, I can still remember that time when Donald Trump was in Iowa and he was asked by Frank Luntz at this evangelical Christian gathering, you know, have you ever asked God for forgiveness? Or what have you asked God for forgiveness? Do you remember this one?
And, I do.
And Trump basically goes through and very explicitly goes,
What do I have to ask forgiveness for?
I've never done anything wrong in my life.
I just try to do better. But no, I don't think I've ever repented. I've ever said, no. And you're thinking...
Well, like Mary and the Immaculate Conception, he was conceived without sin, and so therefore Donald Trump doesn't need to ask repentance or forgiveness at all.
But right? This is one of those funny collective lies. This is like one of those things about Donald Trump, right? That everybody tells themselves this collective lie, this narrative that he is at all Christian, right? Like people ask, like in good faith, well, what's your favorite Bible verse?
The eye for an eye, right?
What's
your favorite book? Well, it's my book first.
Yeah.
Anything from 2 Corinthians. And one of the things that I liked about that Christianity Today piece was it said to people, you have to sort of reconcile, you will have to answer to God for this. Like, there will be accountability for this, or how do you reconcile this? And I thought that was important because there's so much. I hear this all the time when I do these focus groups with Republicans, the extent of the rationalizing about why people support Donald Trump. And I wonder sometimes, how do you get people off that and say, like, oh, I hadn't quite thought of that before? And I think somebody raising the specter of there being eternal accountability for some of these choices could be the kind of thing that actually hits some people for the first time in a different kind of way. I don't know if you agree.
I think that there's a huge section, you know, we see the complete true believer sometimes on television or in social media, but I think that people have just compartmentalized this so thoroughly with this, you know, even though we mock the King David was an adulterer thing, that the people go, okay, you know what, he's a complete jerk, he's a terrible human being, he's awful, he's, you know, he's a crook, he's corrupt, he's done all of these terrible things, but that's not my problem because I'm just with the policy, I'm with the guy. And therefore, I give myself permission to ignore everything else that he does. That, you know, I forgive myself because there's a larger cause. And quite frankly,
because you're just here for the tariffs, right? I'm just here for the tariffs.
It's very interesting reading a lot of the reaction. And the reaction to this Christianity Today thing, I mean, is lit. And you can tell that for a lot of evangelical Christians, and, you know, it's here goes my mentions, but where Christianity seems to be, the beginning and end of Christianity seems to be your position on abortion. I mean, that is the alpha and the omega. That's it. As long as you are right on abortion, you are a Christian. If you're wrong on abortion, no matter what else you've done in your life, no matter what else you believe, you are in outer darkness. And that is the sum total. I know that's simplifying, but that seems to be the theme that runs through so much of this.
Yeah,
you can
well,
slap
I think that's,
me. I mean,
that's no. I think that's basically right. And you know, you take anybody anywhere who's good on abortion, and then you'll have to. Well, they're Christian. You know, they may not know they're Christian, but they're. I mean, forget the fact that like white nationalists are good on abortion. They're good on abortion for very different reasons, which is that they don't want the great replacement to take place. It's utter insanity. And also, if I could say, there is this weird belief or rationalization in pro-life circles that the full accounting on abortion ends tomorrow. Right.
Yeah,
so,
right.
Every good you're going to get out of pro-life policies and every downside you're going to get from political outcomes ends tomorrow. Like, you know, it's at midnight tonight, all the ledger is cut down and we're gonna do the full accounting then, with no understanding that this stuff stretches on for decades, right? This is a generations long fight. And if what the upside of Donald Trump is that he winds up absolutely crippling the pro-life movement for a generation, then whatever gains you get from him in years 1 through 4, and then downstream trickles from judicial appointments, wind up paling in comparison to this. And this is what I think makes it, for me at least, easy to look at many of these pro-life arguments in favor of Trump and say, well, this is just a smokescreen. You don't really believe this.
Yeah.
Because if we were really doing a full accounting here, then it is at best a 50-50 proposition. You know, maybe in the long run, Trump winds up being good for the pro-life movement. Maybe in the long run, he winds up being really bad. I mean, you look at the numbers like the political ID numbers on people under the age of 30. And over the last 4 years, they have swung wildly out to the left, right? Young people have always been liberal. Young people have always been Democratic. But the fact is they get older and they change and they move and they shift along. That's not happening at as high a rate as it used to be. The young voter ID numbers are even more extreme than they used to be. If the net result is we go to like 10 or 15 years where Democrats are plus 8 more than they would have been sans Donald Trump, then you get no gains from this, right? I mean, you know,
right.
in the 4 or 8 or 12 years where you get large Democratic control over government, all of those gains that you might have gotten under Trump are just sunk.
Well, this is why they take the court so seriously, though, just to push back. I mean, they would argue is that, yeah, well, look at all of these, not just the Supreme Courts, but also all the appellate courts and everything else, where we've
right.
now stacked
them. But
you
reap all those gains right now.
And, well, those are lifetime appointments.
Well, they're lifetime appointments. But again, the lifetime appointments are always rolling. And so the next president is going to get a bunch of lifetime appointments. The president after that is going to get a bunch of lifetime appointments. The idea that like your lifetime appointments at this one moment in this cycle are 5 times that of every other president, or that's just not the way it works.
Well, and also, I mean, let's say they get everything they wanted and Roe versus Wade is overturned, then it goes back to the states. So there's still going to be an ongoing, rolling, you know, societal judgment on abortion. Okay, so since we've been beating up on the Christian right here, let's flip it around. Who wants to talk about TERFs? TERFs.
I think Sarah wants to talk about TERFs.
Hashtag JK Rowling is a TERF is a huge top trending topic that day. And I bring this up completely admitting that I've never heard the term TERF before.
Okay, good, because I have no idea what you're talking about right now.
No. No, never. Trans exclusive radical feminist. Okay, let me give people's background. Everybody knows who J.K. Rowling is. She put out a tweet.
She wrote Star Wars, Sarah.
Yeah, exactly.
Sarah, I know you're furiously Googling on your phone. She wrote the Star Wars movie.
Interestingly, I don't know who wrote the Star Wars movie, but I do know what J.K. Rowling wrote. Okay.
Dress however you please. Call yourself whatever you like. Sleep with any consenting adult who will have you. Live your best life in peace and security. Okay, this sounds pretty, like, you know, right? Pretty woke.
I'm on board.
Then she says, but force women out of their jobs for stating that sex is real? Hashtag, I stand with Maya. And everybody lost their shit about this. Because you know what this is about?
Who's Maya?
Okay. So Maya is, here's the background of this. A woman named Maya Fortaster. It's a four-stater. She is used to work for a Christian social group, and she got fired because she basically says that she says that men are men, women are women. She believes that she says there are two
sexes. Can't do that.
She says that sex is a biological fact. It is immutable. There are two sexes. Men are men. Women are female. It is impossible to change sex. There were until recently, very recently understood as basic facts as life. So she's fired for this. She goes to court. The court in Britain slaps her down as basically saying that her position does not deserve any respect in a democratic society. And a London judge this week upheld her firing, finding that her views of sex and gender were absolutist and incompatible with human dignity and fundamental rights of others. So J.K. Rowling, who is like, hey, I'm as woke as anybody in the world. Dress however you want. Call yourself whatever you want. Sleep with anybody you want. Live your best life, blah, blah. But firing somebody for having this opinion, that's going too far. And this thing is a huge controversy. Because
I believe Vox.com said that she has ruined Harry Potter.
Yeah,
that
Vox,
nobody can possibly enjoy Harry Potter anymore.
Yeah, so I mean,
is there more to this story? Did she just have this opinion, or was there some like actual precipitating event?
I believe there has been rumblings before that they believed that she was transphobic, but that this tweet was
not J.K. Rowling. This Maya person.
Oh, I don't know.
I guess this is my question.
I think she was outspoken about it. And the one question I have is whether or not she engaged in any really offensive behavior. But it does seem as if it is her opinion that she wouldn't budge from that is now deemed to be so beyond the pale that she deserves no respect and can be fired for it. So I read this as J.K. Rowling standing up for freedom of conscience and freedom of speech, as opposed to, you know, having to do this. But now in the way it's being framed by Vox, as JVL just mentioned, is like, no, she's come out of the closet as this trans, you know, transgender bigot, or a TERF, which again is... What is this? A TERF is trans-exclusive radical feminist.
I don't know that TERFs are absolutely worse than Republicans, but they're probably close. It's a very bad thing to be a TERF.
Yeah, so this is where you have the culture wars.
Sarah has this pained look on her face.
Well, I'm still trying to wrap my head around it. I think
Sarah, whatever you say, you'll be canceled. Just so you know that, right? You've just figured, you gamed this out. If I say this, I'm canceled. If I say this, I'm canceled. If I say this, I'm canceled. And you're right.
Well, let me just say a few things on the trans issue really quickly. On this trans-exclusive radical feminist, to me, this is what? This is sort of a women's and gender studies circular firing squad, right?
Yes.
This is like where you get the feminist to be like, okay, but if you're a male who has transitioned to a female,
we don't want you to get
$9. Right, okay.
To which we say, you're a bigoted TERF.
Right.
Go away. You're canceled.
Uh-huh. Okay. Interesting. Okay, but here's the... So, I guess... On this issue, I think that J.K. Rowling is probably in the right, because it is, you know, we have to in a pluralistic society. And this is, I think, where the right gets really freaked out by the left is the idea that, you know, you could lose your job simply for expressing these opinions, which I, of course, don't think anybody should. On the flip side, what's the name of that, like, pop psychology guy on the right that everyone listens to now?
Dr. Drew.
No, I am actually
Dr. Phil.
I'm being too.
Jordan Peterson.
Thank you.
Oh,
yeah.
Good. All right.
So maybe less pop than you were thinking. But he has this thing where he refuses to call people by the sex that they wish to be identified from, and to me, so if he wants to do that, okay. I don't think he should be fired. But I also think it's like a jerky thing to do. Like, it's an unkind thing to do, because people are asking you to say, they're saying, this is who I believe I am. This is how I want to present. And it's different from things like, how do you engage with sports and other things where it gets much messier. But I feel like it is one of those things where I also don't know that I would make this person. I wouldn't like lionize them,
okay. So,
because I think it's being unkind.
And I don't know all the details of this. So Sarah, you are saying that you think J.K. Rowling is correct, probably in the.
I think that she's
right.
Correct that somebody ought not be fired for
so,
it. Yes.
JVL, what was your best memory of Sarah Longwell?
You know, I was wondering, could we talk about African American voters and Pete Buttigieg?
I'm a big Pete fan. I have to tell you,
he's
I
great.
Am
very short.
I am getting
he's very very short.
I am
whatever.
Getting...
He came for Elizabeth Warren so hard last night. It was so good.
Because look, I was on the Nicole Wallace show yesterday, and they were doing this thing where they were going around talking about how, you know, react to the lack of diversity on the Democratic debate panel. And everybody's, you know, this is terrible, terrible, terrible. And I said, wait, there really was some diversity. There is some diversity on that stage. And we have the first openly gay man who's running for president of the United States. And I'm just really struck by how incredibly vicious the attacks on him are. As an outsider, I just think it's kind of amazing. And, of course, that
Andrew
was
Yang, first Asian guy to get this far, right?
Yeah.
I believe.
Exactly. Okay, so let's confess. I did not watch the debate, but in my defense, I sort of Twitter watched it, which means that I have all the cool opinions and insights into it. So who watched and didn't watch the debate?
I watched the last hour of the debate, but I will admit that I went to a party first.
Okay.
And so... I watched it not entirely, not at my sharpest,
okay.
Let's say.
Fair.
Oh, because you ate too much?
I it was a celebration.
Okay, that's fair. And JVL?
So I did not. I'm trying to avoid coming down with a cold, so I took a fistful of NyQuil and then had these fever dreams about me and Elizabeth Warren driving through Iowa together, like Thelma and Louise.
Wait, you had a few. You could have dreamt about anyone with that NyQuil. You could have had any fantasy in the world. And you had a fantasy about Elizabeth Warren.
Well, she wants
Iowa.
To stick it to the billionaires. You know what's funny is that in my dream world, I wasn't even there as a journalist. I was there as like a campaign advisor. I was like, you know, I really think that we ought to talk less about Medicare for all and a little bit more about confiscatory tax rates on billionaires, because that's a winner. And she was like, no, I agree. I don't know why I got sidetracked by that. It was amazing.
Charlie, you need to know two things about JVL's dreamscape life. Mm. One is...
sad, isn't it?
Young Elizabeth Warren is like just JVL's speed. He has like a whole weird thing about that. And two, many of his dreams involve Thelma and Louise style death packs. For whatever reason, it comes up a lot.
There is a pattern there.
Great.
So, I mean, I know you're very interested in Tulsi, so I was kind of wondering Elizabeth Warren rather than Tulsi. Because
tell me about what you guys learned about the debates, though.
Oh, what I learned about the debates?
Yeah.
Well, couple things. Number one, once again, Joe Biden did exactly as well as he was, would hope he would do. This was clearly his best debate. I mean, even the people who've been ripping and dragging on him were saying, hey, where's this guy been? I never thought he was as bad as everybody said he was, but he's getting great reviews on Twitter, which is amazing. But my main takeaway, though, is Pete Buttigieg is a gifted political animal. He can throw punches. He can take them. And he, you know, look, no normal human being was actually watching this. It's not going to actually change any votes. You know, after Christmas, everyone's going to have forgotten about it. But it does feed this narrative that this guy is really for real. And I thought the fact that he was able to take Elizabeth Warren's best stuff and sort of, you know, turn it back on her was kind of an impressive moment.
It was an excellent moment for him. He clearly knew it was coming. He was locked and loaded, and he was ready to tell everybody on that stage that they were all millionaires, which is true, and I actually hadn't thought about it. They were either millionaires or billionaires. And she had 100 times more net worth than he did. And I thought that was an excellent comeback to her sort of weird wine cave, you hang out with fancy billionaires for your fundraising. And then he had these, you know, this perfectly reasonable... hey, you know what? I'm going to take money from people who are supporting the cause because that's how you do this thing. And, you know, when her stuff gets sort of laid bare for the fraud that it is, it always feels so good when he's just able to say, like, actually, these are patently absurd things that you say and they don't actually work in the real world. And let me tell you how the real world does work.
Yeah, maybe you shouldn't come up with a purity test that you can't pass yourself.
Oh, such a good line.
Ooh, that was a tough one. Okay, so... I without special pleading, honestly, because I was on a plane this morning coming back from New York, so I was able to read all kinds of stuff. I have to say, I think Tim Miller's take on the bulwark was really outstanding, and I think was the best piece, because instead of just doing this sort of blow by blow back and forth, he basically steps back and goes, "Okay, guys, you understand." This was your PBS, NPR, debate, and whoever gets this nomination is going to go into a WWE fight with Donald Trump, and basically makes the point, look, these guys are ankle-biting each other about the size of their donors and all of this inside baseball, and none of them really seems to have the understanding of the magnitude of the crisis posed by Donald Trump. So, I mean, did you take there are people who push back and say, look, this is a primary. You expect that they'll do that in the general election. But it is amazing 2 days after the impeachment that there was very little interesting commentary about Trump's conduct and his character. In a lot of the back and forth about campaign finances in the shadow of nothing we're talking about is anything close to what Donald Trump is doing. There's a great line in Tim Miller's piece. Let me read this. During a heated back and forth on the candidates' respective campaign finance policies, which in the grand scheme of things barely differ at all, not a single candidate took the opportunity to mention that all of their arguments pale in comparison to the sitting president literally inviting foreign interference into the campaign and enjoying an unprecedented enrichment of his family through taxpayer dollars. A casual viewer would have come away from the debate thinking that having a fundraiser in a wine cave is the most relevant financial scandal in the campaign. Yeah, I thought that was a really good point. It just, it's these guys have memorized the number of billionaire donors one another has gotten. It's like, guys, do you understand that we are in the shadow of this massive story of corruption and impeachment? So is that unfair? Is that too harsh on them?
No, I think it's completely right. You know, Mike Murphy has this, he calls them slappy fights, between these left-wing guys. And it's weird because it wasn't just this debate. It's been like this the whole time. They don't realize that what they're really auditioning for is being the person that can take Donald Trump limb from limb. And that's actually why Kamala Harris, when she had that, it was actually a very stupid point about busing that she didn't even believe. But what it showed people and what got them excited was the idea that she was actually bringing a gun to a gunfight, and that she looked like somebody who could reckon with Donald Trump. And I don't understand why. I feel like the person, and Biden maybe does this more than anybody else, but it is really going to be the person who says, I can go toe-to-toe to this guy and win. And I think that the more that these guys get mired down in process and the slappy fights, the worse it is, the more it diminishes all of them. And more than anything, it doesn't prep them for the final fight.
Yeah, well, this is the point. I mean, so if Elizabeth Warren is the nominee, she's going to have to answer Pocahontas every single time. If Pete Buttigieg is the nominee, he's going to have to answer the gay stuff. Like, it's going to be like, well, you know, this guy, he's a poofter. How's he going to stand up to Kim Jong-un or something, right? I mean, this is
Donald Trump is not going to use a classy British slur.
Well, he'll use some sort of slur, right? I mean, there's 100% chance that if Pete Buttigieg is the nominee.
I did not have the word poofter on my bingo card today for this podcast.
If Bernie
Billy
Sanders is it's going to be socialist, right? Mm. And these are things that none of these guys have had to answer yet. And if Biden is, it's going to be your son is corrupt and you're too old. Look, your eyes exploding. And none of these things, any of the big four, none of them have had to answer these questions.
Yeah, no, actually,
frankly, to be honest, the one moment that I think that has been the most dispositive on the question of fighting back against Donald Trump has been the moment Joe Biden had against that idiot heckler in Iowa where
he challenged him to a push-up contest.
This Trumpy guy gets up there and starts mouthing off in a very Trumpy way to Biden and just spewing Fox News talking points and lying about it. And Biden just tears him limb from limb in this aggro display where he calls him fat and says, you know, you want to, I'll challenge you to anything. Push-ups, run a mile, an IQ test. That was the sort of aggro.
He kept calling him Jack?
Version. Yeah.
Okay, which I'm pretty sure isn't his name.
All right, but that's the sort of aggro you're going to have to show against Trump.
Okay, so here's you've inspired a fantasy that I have. I don't think that Donald Trump's ever going to debate, but let's assume that he does. This is part of the asymmetry that you have to deal with. So they'll be having a discussion about tariffs and trade wars or whatever, and Donald Trump will turn to Joe Biden and say, "You are so old. Your eye just exploded. What you just said. Your eye just exploded. You know, you're losing it right here on stage." And Joe Biden will go, "No, it didn't. No, it didn't." And of course, everybody will see that his eye has not in fact exploded. But he'll say, "It exploded," and the fake news media will not tell you that it exploded. And of course, you know, MAGA world will explode with, "Oh my God, look what happened here. You know, Joe Biden just completely lost it on the stage." And Biden will go, "This is just not true. It is not true. You are lying about it." And then of course we'll have the meta-analysis that Donald Trump succeeded in rattling Joe Biden by claiming, it turns out falsely, that his eye had just exploded on stage. I mean, you know, this is going to be the just like mind-bending attack on the space-time continuum that no one is prepared for.
Yeah, we just got to go over the top at them, right? I mean, as a comms matter, what do you think about this? I mean, I've always thought, honestly, this was one of my little fantasies, was that back during the 2016 debates, is that at some point Marco Rubio should have like left his podium, walked over, gotten up in Trump's face, and like slugged him, and that would have like ended the contest right there. You know, like big tough bully Donald Trump is exposed as being the worst. Even this little show pony could deck.
Do that, though.
Yeah. But no, I really do think the way to get to Trump is to go over the top at him, not to argue back at him. Arguing back is not, but to sort of argue over him straight at. But maybe I'm wrong. And also to laugh. This is the other deep point that Mike Murphy and David Axelrod made in that Bill Kristol conversation, was that the thing that drives Trump crazy is being
see, that. That I think
fun.
Is. Yes, I can see that because once
right.
the crowd starts laughing at him, then that's going to trigger him.
Because he wants to be a strong man.
That's right. And that's why I think, you know, one of the things that I, early, this is before, I think maybe even Joe Biden was running, but he had that line where he was like, "I'm going to take Donald Trump behind the shed and beat him up. You know, he had some. It was, I thought that was so stupid. And I think that you cannot let Donald Trump, and this is where Marco Rubio, what lost it for Marco Rubio, remember him, he decided to go toe-to-toe, got down in the mud and started saying, you know what they say about guys with little hands.
His polling was actually very good during that week.
Whatever. This is, no, I don't
this
think
is the
so.
Conventional
I think, I,
wisdom
no,
here
no,
is
no,
that, like,
no,
oh, that
no,
killed
no,
him.
No.
It really helped him for a week.
It diminished him.
He didn't commit hard enough.
Okay. This is, yeah, if he decked him on stage, that would have just fixed everything. I don't agree with any of this. What I think is this idea of, because this is actually how people rationalize Trump in some ways that they don't. This is clear of all the anti-Trumpers on Twitter. What do? They just mock. They treat Trump very lightly. They don't take him too seriously. And that's how they can sort of like hold him. And I feel like if somebody comes in and finds a way to be sly, and this is what I think Buttigieg can do. He seems unflappable in this way where he could. I thought his response to say the nickname, the Alfred E. Newman nickname, where he was like, maybe I'm too young. I don't get the reference or something. Yeah. Like,
okay,
those
boomer.
Are the winners. That's the way to handle him.
Well,
okay,
you know, and
yeah.
Amy Klobuchar, you know, made the point about, you know, what a coward he was that he ran away, that he actually ran away from the NATO summit. I think the things that make him a figure of fun that actually go right to what he thinks his strength is. He thinks his strength is that he is the Uberman, right? That he is this masculine fighter. If he's perceived to be the whining schoolboy that in fact he is, I think, you know, you can get under his skin. I don't know. Okay, so one of the minor takeaways, but I'm always obsessed with these things. Sarah Huckabee. You know what I'm talking about, Sarah Huckabee.
Yeah, it's such a good. This is such a good.
Okay.
This is such,
I know
this
nothing
is such
about
a good
this.
Mini scandal.
Well,
such
it,
a good mini
it
scandal.
It illustrates so much. So Joe Biden is now becoming more open about the fact that he had, when he was a child, that he had a terrible stutter and that he's worked on it his whole life. And he's talking about how he deals with the advice he gives to a young child who suffers from stuttering. I don't know, that has a stutter, working through the stutter. And Sarah Huckabee mocks him on Twitter, like, I don't understand what Joe Biden is trying to say. And they push back on her and saying, and it actually was a very gracious tweet saying, this is something I have struggled with my whole life. I'm trying to, pass along the word how to do this. Maybe a little empathy would help. And Sarah Huckabee did something that was a little bit startling. I didn't think it was a great apology, but she did say, I didn't realize this was going on. I apologize, et cetera, et cetera. I thought it was very on brand, the juvenile insulting, taunting of somebody who has a disability, which has now become acceptable and sort of the norm. It's kind of one of the marks of Trump world, that everybody wants to be Kurt Schlichter, I guess. Very off-brand that Sarah Huckabee would, in fact, apologize. So, Sarah, what part of that did you want to dive in on?
Well, so I was watching that part when he did it. It was like one of the very last things he did. And he did this thing where he stuttered in what seemed like an on-purpose kind of way to sort of emphasize the fact that he had this stuttering problem. But if she wasn't paying close attention, I guess when I woke up this morning and I saw the whole thing, I saw her apologize. I immediately went to like read how people were receiving the apology, and everyone was like, screw you, too little, too late, you're the worst, you know. And I guess there's just this part of me that thought, if she really didn't know and you watched that happen and you weren't sort of paying close, it wasn't actually entirely clear to me whether he was stuttering for the emphasis of the point that he was making or whether he was actually having trouble getting it out. And I sort of could see, of course it's terrible what she did. Like, it is their MO to like mock people, but I thought her apologizing was good. And I hate it when people do apologize and then everyone is like, nope, you're not allowed to apologize. We just like create no incentives for people to walk things back and try to be like, you know what? Because she said, like, I didn't realize he had that disability. I'm sorry. I actually thought it was good that she apologized. And we should let people apologize.
I agree. I thought it was, she could have been a little bit more gracious about it. But I take your point. But I think it's also interesting, though, that so earlier this week, you had the president in Michigan mocking the late John Dingell by suggesting that he was perhaps in hell. And
then he apologized, right? Oh, no, just kidding. Just kidding.
About it. He has many opportunities, including his spokesman. So Stephanie Grisham comes out, and she is, by the way, it's starting to dawn on me that perhaps she's not very good at her job, says, well, you know, he was just punching back. Yeah, John Dingell's been dead for months now, so John Dingell wasn't punching him. This guy, Hogan Giggly, or whatever his name is, you know, is also saying, well, people can take apart anything that the president says. Just how about a human apology? Isn't this something that men do? You know, I was walking past the newsstand where the Atlantic has this thing, you know, what does it mean to be a man and all the problems of, you know, raising young boys to be men. Isn't that one of the fundamental points, JVL, that you teach young boys that men will own up to their mistakes and they will apologize? But this is this thing in Trump world where you just, no matter how much you've stepped in it, no matter how, you know, how offensive you've been, you just do not ever, ever, ever apologize. Never give an inch.
So here is my question for you guys, because I'm not on Twitter. What was the MAGA world reaction to Sarah Huckabee Sanders's apology?
Well, it
did they go after her for why are you apologizing? Or did they rally around and defend her and say, look, see, she apologized, cut her a break?
Yeah, I mean, I think people did defend her. I mean, there were people who criticized, as Sarah mentioned. Then, of course, there's Kurt Schlichter, who's I mentioned several times. This is what he wrote. He said, tell me why I should give a shit about someone making fun of Joe Biden because he stuttered. I just want to know what the rule is. What's the rule? Because I don't think that's actually the rule, or at least it wasn't until it became convenient, in which case, screw that. So that's the...
Yeah, well, I really care what Kurt has to say. The reason I ask this is because the Sarah Huckabee Sanders apology creates a cognitive dissonance for Trump supporters. Because if Sarah Huckabee Sanders was right to apologize and we should all cut her a break because she apologized, then it is wrong for Trump not to apologize for all the bad things he does. So when he attacks the New York Times reporter and mimics him having a disability, when he says that John Dingell is in hell, then those things are things which, if Sarah Huckabee Sanders apologized for this, and that's a good thing and we should admire her and cut her a break for it, then there is no way to not look at Trump's things and say, so he should apologize for it. And if they don't, the only way out for them is to go anti Huckabee Sanders and say she had nothing to apologize for. This is wrong. She is wrong to do it and weak to do it. And so I think it puts them in a box. I mean, you do wind up in a place where you have to be a psychopath or, you know, somebody with dementia problems to really go full Trump. It's hard for people who have like a little bit of humanity tucked away somewhere in their souls to do it, because you just got to keep going. You really can't ever apologize.
But see, this is what you don't
understand.
We have always been at war with East Asia. No.
Yeah, it's hard to do, right? I mean, it really is hard to just, it's one thing to say we're going to go Trumpy, but to really take it all the way out where you
or
never apologize for
or
anything.
It's incredibly
that's
easy.
Harder than it looks.
Whatever he does is right.
No, we're that.
I no longer wrestle with these moral dilemmas. I no longer have to reconcile these things with one another. It's just, if he does it, that's what we should do. If he doesn't apologize, it's because he's strong. If he does apologize, see, he is this deeply thoughtful, introspective character. It's just, I'm sorry. I'm getting a little cynical, aren't I, Sarah, here? So
that's okay. Jump on in. The water's warm.
Yeah, don't take the JVL side. Look, I'm gonna just say for that when Trump said the Dingell thing, one of the things that was interesting was the crowd, unlike the where people, you know, cheer for the send her back stuff, they actually kind of did a like, like that kind of groan of that wasn't great. I obviously didn't see the whole thing, so I'm sure they lapped up plenty of it. But it was funny watching his body language where, you know, he just keeps pressing on. Like he doesn't take that sort of feedback and think like, well, maybe I should apologize in this moment really quickly. Like I clearly crossed a line and the audience just let me know it. He just like barrels
ahead.
Okay,
so random break in topic here. You follow that story, all the headlines and the commentary about the Army-Navy game where all of the cadets were caught making these hand gestures, these little, you know, okay symbols, white power. Well, yeah. Apparently a few minutes ago, West Point releases their findings into the hand gestures made at the Army-Navy game. The school says the cadets were playing, wait for it, the circle game and not making white power symbols.
Is that like the devil's triangle? Is that what the kids do these days?
It's all very confusing.
Is this a Snapchat thing?
What is the circle game? Isn't it? Is it like you get somebody to look at your hands in the circle and then you punch them?
Yeah.
I don't know.
I think that is.
Is that what they do at your daycare?
I sort of feel like this was a thing when I was a kid that, you know, you would like hold it down, and the second you got somebody to look, you would just punch them.
Okay. The circle game's goal is to trick.
Did you ever play Peditle?
Oh.
No.
Really? If there's like a one headlights out and you're in the car with somebody, you see it first, you say Peditle, and sometimes you punch somebody if you see a punch, like a buggy?
No.
Literally none of these things.
I went to Quaker school. We sat around singing Walk in the Light. We did not do any of these crazy, cruel things that you did at your military academy.
Okay. So you wanted to look at the
military academy.
Okay. In the background?
Yeah, tell me.
The circle game's goal is to trick someone into looking at your hand while you're making a circle with the index and thumb. If you look, you get punched in the arm. It's an old game popularized by a 2000 episode of Malcolm in the Middle, but it's also a running meme on YouTube and TikTok. This is from the Washington Post, TikTok. So I did not make this up. I have to say that there was not 1% of me that did not think that this was going to end this way. But if you watch the coverage of this, the deep breathing, more evidence of et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, blah, 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 blah. Well, this is how you've got the whole Covington kids thing that is that's going on. Okay, so, hey, there was an impeachment this week. You probably don't remember this.
Was it this week?
The meh impeachment?
Feels like it was 4 weeks
ago. So do you remember, Sarah, when the president wanted to buy Greenland?
Yeah. What's the time check on that? How long ago was that?
August. Okay. So,
yeah, I bet it's like only like 3 months ago or something.
When he
that's right.
But those were sort of benign, harmless ones. This is kind of a big deal. Look, this is a big deal. The president of the United States is impeached, and of course, you know, we're not going to know how history remembers this until the whole story is over. We're only halfway through. We're not even halfway through this. You know, we have to know what happens with the Senate trial. Do they treat it like a joke? Is there more evidence that comes out? And then, of course, there is the first time ever of a president being impeached running for reelection. If Donald Trump is reelected, this impeachment will always be cast as a bad political move, correct? But
I think so.
I agree with that. But I'm still willing to stand here and say, even if there's political downside, this was the right thing to do. Now, I would have done it differently than they did. I would have added more articles. I would have been more aggressive in trying to get more witnesses and more documents. I don't think they needed to rush it. But this is the kind of thing for which impeachment was put into the Constitution. I think they did the right thing. And you know what I was really struck by? You know, how many conversations have we had about the lack of political courage in Washington these days? If you did a volume of Republican profiles in courage, it would be a really, really slim volume. There were a couple dozen Democrats who actually, you know, committed some flagrant acts of political courage by voting for impeachment, even though they represent districts that Donald Trump won.
Yeah, but they shouldn't have. It shouldn't have been like that because, I mean, I have I think the Democrats made some real mistakes here, and one of them is that they didn't fight hard to get these witnesses. It seemed like they impeached him because they felt like they had to. Then they didn't really try to marshal all of the things that they needed to make it stick. So one of them was getting the witnesses. The other one was pushing public opinion and putting some muscle behind. I mean, I couldn't believe the extent to which the Democrats were forced to go on defense when it should have been all permanent offense. When the Ukraine thing breaks, right, you see the numbers move immediately. Independents start breaking. You even get some Republicans. Everybody thinks, oh, this is nice and clear. You know, it gets up above 50% for people that you think should impeach. And then what does Donald Trump do? he and the RNC and all of the Republican super PACs just start dumping millions into public opinion, and they extinguish sort of the public opinion fire that had been created around this, and they really line up their people with a couple of very clear talking points. Look, you can't impeach him. It's going to be an election soon. It's 2020. Hey, they're all corrupt. You know, different. Read the transcript, whatever. They lock people up. And the Democrats really didn't put up a persuasion fight to help push public opinion on their sides. And so what happened was, first Donald Trump and the RNC, they locked up their people, and then they pushed into the vulnerable Dem districts with a lot of money, and they said they were going after them. And so it ended up being that in the territory of the Democrats had to be the ones to show the political courage, not the Republicans. Like, the story should have been about Will Hurd and Adam Kinzinger and Mike Gallagher and those guys showing political courage. But ultimately, they were able to fight to a draw, basically, you know, a disinformation draw, because institutional Democratic money decided to kind of sit out the public opinion battle around this, which I'll never quite understand.
So had the Democrats done that, though, then the rap against them would be, look how political this whole thing was. Right. I mean, from the
that's
very
the
beginning,
rap against them already anyway.
Well, I know. Well, but this at the very beginning, it was, you know, the Peggy Noonans of the world said, we got to watch and see. And the Democrats have to play this really straight. And if they play it really straight, then they will maybe have been able to convince the country. And I think the Democrats played it pretty straight. Not perfectly.
Congressional Democrats have to play it straight. The public opinion battle is a hardball battle
that the Republicans
are fighting with everything they got.
And there's also just a slightly different point on this, is leaving aside the public relations campaign, I mean the political ad campaigns. They moved so quickly, sort of like they were checking their boxes, and there was sort of naivete. Okay, so you had, you know, 1 week of really, really good testimony, really, really good, compelling testimony. Okay, and we're done. It's like, wait, what do you mean? This is working for you. You ought to spread this out. Also, there's something to be said for letting public opinion catch up. Not everybody is watching this stuff. Not everybody is following this. So, to the extent that you can fill in the gaps, you can begin to tell the narrative over and over again. But also, I don't think it's going to look good in either the trial or in retrospect that they didn't push harder for more of those documents, that they did not wage a more aggressive campaign in the courts to get the witnesses compelled to testify. This administration has not turned over a single piece of paper, other than that, you know, quasi-transcript of the phone call. I mean, that's the obstruction thing. But it's like, why did you stop doing it? Richard Nixon fell immediately after the U.S. Supreme Court ruled unanimously that he had to turn over the tapes. So Congress's efforts to get going to the courts to compel him to not obstruct the investigation was the decisive moment in Watergate, the precipitating moment that led to Richard Nixon's resignation. And it was the Democrats like, no, we got our evidence. Let's move ahead. Let's do this. Let's get this done before Christmas. And it's like, well, what?
Well, I mean, yeah. not to defend the Dems, because that's not my job. They were operating under the constraints of, I mean, having impeachment drag into primary voting is like a real, maybe it's okay, but maybe it's not okay. And I think they had a first do no harm thing here, which is that the guy who was most likely to be their nominee is up plus 10. He's been plus 10 for 9 months. If you're running like that, maybe impeachment gets you to plus 12, but maybe if you screw it up, it takes you down to plus 5, right? And then all of a sudden you're in toss-up territory. I believe that all of their options were bad options. They were trying to find the least bad of bad options, which is always the hardest thing to do in the world. And that they, my suspicion is that the guiding principle was first do no harm.
I understand that, but I think that showed a defensiveness rather than a confidence in the evidence. You know, there's so many.
Yeah, I mean, the Democrats are scared of they're scared of their own shadow. They're constantly afraid of a backlash. They think that they're just like so worried that they're going to give Donald Trump some superpower. And the thing is, if you're going to impeach him, then what do you got to do? You got to get this stuff all out. And you know, Donald Trump, you cannot, you know, Charlie, you asked about the political ramifications of how people will think about this in the future. My biggest concern is the precedent that it sets, that a president can just stonewall like this and refuse to allow witnesses to testify. And, you know, I think you have to go to the mat over things like that, because otherwise, what is congressional oversight for?
I think this is a good issue for the Democrats, this pushing for witnesses and actual a real trial. I mean, right now, I know that Nancy Pelosi is getting beaten up for not immediately sending it over. But I do think that there's a strong case to be made. Look, right now, there's a real clear and present danger, I think, that Donald Trump, that they will rig this trial, that they will make it into a sham trial, and that Donald Trump will immediately declare he's completely exonerated, will feel empowered. Actually, I heard a guy yesterday say that the White House is already planning a national sort of a stumping tour, you know, a victory lap where they send the president out, you know, post acquittal to say, see, there was nothing to this. The Democrats are trying to kill me, you know, not only solidifying their base, but using this as a real weapon to get the Trump favorable non-voters to come out. They, I mean, they think that there's a lot of you know, folks that they can add to the electorate in 2020, and they will use this particular issue. So Democrats need to keep this in mind. So I do think to keep, you know, keep the pressure on, particularly these vulnerable Democrats. Do you really want to shut down this trial? Are you really want to go through with this, you know, this fake trial where there are no witnesses, where we don't even pretend that we want to get to the truth? You know, I mean, Democrats say, we think that the trial ought to, we think the American public, you know, ought to see a trial that will get to the truth of what happens. I think that's not a terrible argument for them to make.
Yeah, I agree, I think. And they're especially helped by Trump having said that he wants the full trial with witnesses and everything, right? I mean, he went on Fox and Friends and said that early in this. And you could just play that over and over and over again with the tagline, what are they scared of?
Exactly, right? Yeah.
Yeah, why? I should do that.
Someone should.
It's a good ad.
Because it's...
We are running an ad, the What Are They Afraid Of? But it you know, it's showing Mick Mulvaney and Pompeo and Giuliani. But that Trump quote is exactly right. And we should it should be used against Trump the way that they used Nancy Pelosi's line about how it needed to be a bipartisan impeachment effort in order for it to be legitimate. Because they took that line and they said, oh, well, if that's the case, then we'll just not make this bipartisan and therefore it will be illegitimate.
Yeah. Although Charlie and Sarah and I talked about this earlier this week. My personal belief is that if you are the Republicans in the Senate, then no price is too great to pay to keep Giuliani and Trump off the stand.
No.
Because you can't allow there is no way in which you can allow them to testify because they can't do so without perjuring themselves.
Yeah, that is objectively true. There's no? And everyone knows that, and I don't, you know, even Lindsey Graham knows that. Now, of course, how did they do during the Clinton trial? They basically had to videotape depositions, you deposed, and then played segments of them during the trial. So here.
Yeah, you can't allow Trump to be deposed. He can't be put under oath.
But everybody was under oath in the Clinton trials.
I know, but you can't.
Lewinsky,
you can't
everybody.
Do that. You can't do that for Trump. If you're his lawyers, you're the Republican. Allowing him to be deposed under oath is tantamount to having him removed from office.
Leaving Donald Trump aside, who is the unhappiest man in Washington right now? It's a trick question. Chief Justice John Roberts.
Oh.
Who has got to be thinking, oh, you got to be kidding me. I have to get dragged into this. I have to do this. And really, nobody knows how this plays out. So, for example, you know, the rules allow the Chief Justice who presides over this trial to make rulings so that if somebody stands up and says, you know, I believe that we should subpoena John Bolton, the Chief Justice could say, yes, I grant that motion. Or he could simply defer to the Senate. Now, let's just say for the sake of argument, because I don't think that he's going to want to make any real decisions of this at all. But if he says, yes, I grant the motion, I grant the subpoena for John Bolton, that decision can be overridden by a majority of the senators. But think about the position that puts Republican senators in to vote to overrule Chief Justice Roberts on something like that. The opportunity cost is awfully high for them to do that, to repudiate the Chief Justice of their own Supreme Court. So there are some interesting little twists here. I don't have high expectations, but you know, keep in mind that we do have that third element that he hasn't gotten as much attention. What is Roberts going to do? What is he capable of doing? What will he want to do?
And this is one of the reasons I think McConnell is so dead set against witnesses, is because opening up that can of worms is the pathway to a Democratic Senate in 2021, right? I mean, you are facing the prospect of a massive realigning election already. You just have to look at the generic numbers, look at the retirements. I mean, all the signs are very, very bad for Republicans. You have a bunch of vulnerable senators already. The Cook Political Report just today says that actually the Senate is much more competitive than they had expected it to be. If you expose a bunch of vulnerable senators in that way on top of everything else, you are then looking at maybe losing the Senate too, you know, really tilting the scales on that. And I don't know if really all you care about is the pro-life justices and you're just there for the pro-life movement. Well, wouldn't that be a problem?
Yeah, I think you are right. Although
but
again, there are these new polls out as well on these swing states, you know, suggesting that, keep in mind that Donald Trump is still very competitive in the Electoral College here. So I was talking to one of the reporters for Wire Service yesterday, and he has one of these interactive maps on his phone, and he says, look, this is the way I think it's going to play out. He said he thinks there's a very real possibility that Donald Trump could lose the popular vote by a bigger margin this year, like 5 million votes, and still eke out a victory by winning states like my home state here of Wisconsin. You know, getting 271 electoral votes. And he says that will just the country will lose its freaking mind, although he didn't say freaking. Can you, I mean, that didn't.
Yeah, 5 million is the number. I believe when the data nerds have gone and crunched this, the belief is that the highest possible margin where he can still hold on to the Electoral College is 5 million. I would just say that as a matter of practical politics, if you, the incumbent president of the United States, are gaming out your path to reelection 11 months ahead, and the best thing you can come up with is maybe we only lose by 3 to 5 million, but we pull an inside straight to the Electoral College, your chances of victory are very low. This is not – bad always gets worse, right? I mean, what is going to get better for Donald Trump? The only better is Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren as the nominee. And if he can't jigger that, which is why the Ukraine thing all happened, because he doesn't want to face Biden. And any price was worth paying in order to try to not get Biden. Incumbent presidents who are in this bad shape 11 months out do not often recover.
I just remember this conversation, though, of Republicans saying the same thing about Barack Obama back in 2011.
I'm skeptical of JVL's. I think incumbency grants you many extra points. The Electoral College very much plays to his favor, and he's sitting on the buzziest economy that anybody's had in a really long time. And as long as that holds, in any other situation, it wouldn't even be close. The only reason it's close is because Donald Trump sucks so hard. And so
it's almost as if the Republicans had nominated anybody else, they would be having a realigning election of their own.
That's right. Did anybody mention that to them?
Crazy. Okay, right. The most important question, though, since we're going into the weekend here, should I go see the Star Wars movie or not? No?
No. Go see Cats.
Have you read the reviews of Cats?
Little Women is also playing. Little Women is the new version of Little Women is also out.
The Greta Gerwig Little Woman. Go see Richard Jewell.
Have you seen that? It's good.
Richard Jewell.
Have you seen it?
Yeah, I saw it. It's pretty good. I mean, if you need to see a movie, you don't have to go out and see a movie. You could just stay in and rent layer cake.
You know, I try not to do this.
We're not going to have this fight on Charlie's podcast,
so
too.
The Richard Jewell movie, I guess the Olivia Wilde character seems to be deeply unfair to an actual real human being who is dead, the reporter who... female reporter who it implies
not
was
deeply
using
it is mildly unfair to a person who committed an egregious mistake. So I mean, it is mildly unfair to the person who is the villain in this story, like the true real life.
So were you joking about Cats, by the way?
No, she wasn't.
No,
she
I'm
is
not.
As serious
you
as a heart attack.
Read the reviews.
I've refused. I will not be
fake
swayed.
News. Fake news, okay, Charlie. Robbie Elite reviews. Media looking down their nose at Listen Andrew Lloyd Webber's
Glad
masterwork.
To report that somebody is everything yeah. you'd hope for and more. A mesmerizingly ugly fiasco that makes you feel like your brain is being eaten by a parasite. A viewing experience so stressful that it honestly brought on a migraine.
Do they sing?
Memories.
That's all. I just want, as long as they sing.
She is so there for Cats.
I grade on such a serious curve for musicals.
Oh, okay, let's test you. Who had the greatest version of Memories?
I don't know. It's my least favorite
really?
Song in the show.
Linda Ronstadt?
Yeah, it's always like this. It's just like "Don't Cry for Me, Argentina." Those are these they make these breakout songs, but they're never the good ones.
Barbra
well,
Streisand.
No, there's a difference of opinion on it. I think you could certainly make the case. Hold on here. Right? No, you could certainly make the case that that Elaine Page was the greatest, but yeah.
Good one.
I would say Elaine Page, but I actually saw a different version of somebody else who had done it at an awards ceremony who now I can't remember. Betty Buckley, is it?
Well, when I was in high school doing musical theater, the first verse of Memories was the go-to audition song for like every 16-year-old girl in my high school.
Yeah, and that's why people have such a bad feeling about Cats, is because that's the song that they know, where lots of the other songs are delightful.
Rum-tum Tiger is a serious cat.
See, that's great. Yeah. Yes. Mungo Jerry and Rumpelteazer were a notorious couple of cats. They're great. It's all based on a T.S. Eliot. I mean, I don't understand why everybody's so down on it.
Yeah, no, it's impossible to understand why.
Well, I remember seeing it when I was like 10 and the Cats came out in the audience and it was awesome. Thanks for that.
It's going to be an earworm. Just going to have it all weekend. Jonathan yep, Last, yep. Sarah Longwell, thank you so much for coming in for our special weekend pre-Christmas, which we can now say. Edition.
Merry Christmas, Charlie.
Happy Christmas, Charlie.
To everybody, and happy holidays as well.
Because and
we
happy
do have
holidays,
a couple of other
too.
Holidays that are out yep. there. So it's like, I don't think anyone's actually offended about this at all. So, and thank you for listening to today's Bulwark podcast. We will be back next week. We'll take a few days off, and then we will do this all over again.